One of the most famous of Cold War speeches is John F. Kennedy's address to citizens of a divided Berlin on June 26, 1963, a speech epitomizing the divide between the U.S. and its allies on the one side of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union and its buffer states on the other. During the Cold War, several U.S. presidents used rhetoric to project U.S. power and intentions to a world audience. What were their methods? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Allison Prash, professor of communication arts at the UW-Madison and author of The World is Our Stage, The Global Rhetorical Presidency and the Cold War, published in 2023 by the University of Chicago Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
Without trying to pin down something that's not that easy to pin down, shall we define our term first as to the Cold War?
Yes. Well, generally speaking, historians will date the Cold War between 1946 to 1947 and ending really with the fall of the Berlin Wall, but also the end of the Reagan administration between 1989 and 1991. But I think it's important to note that the Cold War, beyond simply being a historical term, is a rhetorical construction. We think about the Cold War as being this massive descriptor for the second half of the 20th century, but in actuality, it is utilized to describe what is not a hot war. It's not in most cases, right? This contest, this ideological contest between often framed as the United States and the Soviet Union, although it's important to note that many other countries and perspectives are engaged in that struggle. But essentially, the U.S. will come to see and define the Cold War as this epic ideological struggle between one way of life and the other, and they will direct massive time, attention, financial resources, and various forms of rhetorical appeals to get the world to side with the United States and in opposition to the Soviet Union.
There are two parts to that rhetoric, as you point out in your book. One is the president's actual utterances, and the other is, where is the president when he makes these utterances? So that is kind of two powerful components of this rhetoric.
Absolutely. And I think, to define our terms, as we think about rhetoric, for a very long time, scholars of speech communication would define rhetoric in a very narrow sense, that being the words that an individual utters, and often it's in front of a public audience. So when it comes to studying presidential rhetoric, that would mean, what do presidents say in front of a political audience, often defined as a U.S.-centric audience? And so I think what I'm trying to do in the book is demonstrate how various U.S. presidents were speaking, uttering words, but also seeking to communicate things beyond their words. So where they were speaking, where they were traveling, various audience they wanted to address, and what those audiences would do in response to the president's words, yes, but also where they were physically placed or present. And that can communicate a lot to us about what presidents were trying to do during the Cold War beyond just their spoken oratory.
Presidential travels began pretty late in the game, didn't they, in terms of the president even leaving the country to do anything, let alone make an address, and not until Theodore Roosevelt goes down to the Panama Canal Zone.
Yeah, in 1906. He's the first president to leave the borders of the nation while in office. And it's actually a pretty significant move. And it's one that a lot of people are concerned about, because essentially, if you think back to early 20th century, a deep concern of the public and members of the government was, how can Teddy Roosevelt do the business of being president if he's not physically in Washington? Now, today, that sounds like a quaint concern.
Doesn't it?
It really does. But, it's interesting, if you read the New York Times accounts of preparing for Roosevelt to go to the Panama Canal Zone, there's all of these reports about how he will be reached and how many telegraph operators will be present or stationed to make sure he can do the business of being president. But if you look at that trip, one of the things that Theodore Roosevelt says, the reason he decides to go is because he says, quote, I want to see how the ditch is getting along myself. And of course, there he's referring to the United States participation in finishing the Panama Canal. And what Roosevelt does quite explicitly is he makes sure that there are photographers with him, newspaper reporters with him, so they can report and show images of him being in this place. And he comes back and he submits to Congress this lengthy report that's an eyewitness account written by himself, and it includes images, pictures of him in the Panama Canal Zone, and it's the first time that images are published in the congressional record. And so one of the things that Roosevelt inaugurates is this idea that a president's movements matter just as much as their words, and they can communicate something to the public, even if this public doesn't necessarily want to read what he's saying, they can see him in this place, and that matters something about U.S. power.
And actually, you touched on a couple of things that become part of this discussion, I think. Ultimately, one is, and Teddy Roosevelt, a great place to start in this sense, because he did write his own stuff.
Yes.
So any kind of rhetoric speech that he's giving, that's him speaking. It's not a team of speechwriters.
He's very, very intentional about what he is communicating, not just in this congressional report, but also what he says to people when he is in the Panama Canal Zone. And he actually says to them, and I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially, you know, you are doing something that is to the credit of the United States, just as you would if you're serving in a war overseas. And it is all for Roosevelt to contribute to this narrative of grandeur and magnitude that he wants to associate with the United States' influence abroad.
And in this case, too, it's easily construed as a positive thing for all the world, for commerce, to shorten the trip around the Horn and
yes.
get through the Panama Canal. Mm-hmm. And it is a marvel of American engineering, but not only. It is kind of a world cooperative project. But the other aspect that strikes me when you mention Theodore Roosevelt is mass communications.
Yes.
If this had happened 20 years earlier with some other president, Cleveland maybe, you would not have had the immediate world dissemination of the message.
Absolutely. Well, and I think as you begin to chart the rise in presidents using their travels abroad as a clear persuasive strategy, we have to acknowledge that it is made possible, not just with Teddy Roosevelt, but more broadly, the rest of the presidents that we'll talk about, is that they are able to disseminate and circulate these images, these visuals, this newsreel footage, whether it's over radio or ultimately, you know, cable news by the time we get to Nixon and Reagan, that they are able to project this image. And so as you chart the changes in this practice, you are also always talking about changes in transportation technology, in the mediation and dissemination of texts. And we see throughout this history that presidents and their advisors are very explicitly aware of how they can utilize those evolutions in mass communication to their advantage.
And we can get to the Cold War per se pretty quickly, but another president that seemed to be a turning point, and one that I think maybe the first one that most of us would associate with an international mm-hmm. presence and an internationally targeted message, would be Woodrow Wilson.
Absolutely. And that really is, you know, if you're charting this story, there are a number of presidents after Roosevelt that do travel abroad, but Wilson is the one who is the first U.S. president to travel to Europe while in office. And that's pretty significant because one of the reasons that there was this impulse against traveling outside of the United States while president, one, it was, can they do the business of being president? But number two, if you think back to some of these, you know, well-known phrases from Washington or Jefferson, this caution of avoiding entangling alliances, and this real concern that if you start getting involved in other people's problems abroad, Europe in particular, you are going to get distracted with the business of building a nation. And this is a precedent that is set and articulated that everyone will follow until we get to Wilson. Now, of course, the context for that is Wilson is going to go to Versailles in the aftermath of World War I, well, what's known as the Great War at the time, and really presents himself as the person who is going to be able to solve and resolve this international conflict. It's important to note with Wilson that a lot of people are really concerned and they are upset about the fact that Wilson is portraying himself as the person that can solve this. And, you know, they believe from a U.S. perspective that really members of Congress should be consulted as well. And so there's this really outcry among some people in the United States, mostly Wilson's, you know, detractors, that he's the one that can go. But when Wilson goes and he's met with cheering crowds and he comes back, he is essentially making the case that, as we know from his statements, that America's job, he believes, is to make the world safe for democracy. And so going to Versailles for Wilson is a physical embodied extension of those words.
Well, in Versailles being the place where the treaty that ended the Great War took place. And so that's another positive symbol for Wilson when he makes this speech about safer democracy and world peace. Then one that surprises me from time to time, getting us that much closer to the Cold War, is FDR and, you know, going to Yalta, of all places, in wartime.
Yes. So Roosevelt makes these pretty courageous trips during World War II, and specifically to meet with various leaders of the Big Three. So he'll meet with Churchill on a number of occasions, but in particular when he's meeting with Churchill and Stalin, of course, the British Prime Minister, and then the Soviet Premier, he will go and he will meet with them at Tehran and Yalta. And in both of those cases, it's interesting to note that Roosevelt is making the choice to travel outside the United States, really at, you know, risk to himself. These trips are top secret. No one knows that they're happening. They don't even know he's left the country until FDR is back on U.S. soil. But they're really an opportunity for Roosevelt to embody and portray this robust image of global leadership, because when he gets back to the United States, his government and various officials are very clear and intentional about disseminating pictures of what will be called the Big Three.
Oh, yes. Very symbolic, isn't it? The three of them seated there together, near but not at the war's end.
Absolutely. At really crucial moments, preparing for various, you know, military offensives. And it's also quite clear that FDR is always in the center chair. He is always essentially representing this link between this, you know, Stalin and Churchill, and that's going to become important when Truman is going to attend a similar meeting. So even though FDR, you know, struggles with a disability, not being able to walk unaided, he is quite intentional about making these trips and knowing that there is a symbolic significance attached to them.
Let's talk about a slightly earlier FDR speech, the most famous, and that's from December 8th, 1941. What kind of image does he project?
Yes. So December 8th, 1941, it's the speech that he is delivering before a joint session of the U.S. Congress in the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And if you watch, you know, footage. We have some footage of that speech, but if you think about the majority of the U.S. public is listening to it over radio, right? They were very accustomed to listen to FDR deliver his famous fireside chats, where he would say, you know, often on a Sunday night, people would gather together and he would begin, "My friends, I want to talk to you about so-and-so, these problems affecting you." So FDR's audience is experiencing it. If you're not in, you know, the Congress in person, you're hearing it over radio. And the image that he projects, both visually and also in audio form, is saying, you know, this is a date that will live in infamy, and then lays out very clearly exactly what the stakes of this particular war are. And we have to remember that, you know, between 1939 and 1941, isolationists had a huge sway over U.S. public opinion. And a lot of that has to do in the aftermath of World War I and this belief that, hey, we got involved in Europe. Remember those avoid entangling alliances? Look what we did. And there's, you know, a widespread belief that, you know, not only did we lose hundreds of thousands of troops, but also this you know, beginning of the Great Depression or leading us into the Great Depression. So FDR has to fight against that, but he also knows the reality of the world situation. He is a student of international affairs. He knows that it is only a matter of time that the United States is going to be brought into this conflict. And so he takes this opportunity to make an argument to his audience that if we do not do something, we've been attacked, so obviously we're in this war, but if we do not do something and if we do not take a leadership war on the global stage, it is at our peril. And so he really utilizes that moment and then his rhetoric throughout the rest of World War II to articulate this robust vision of American internationalism that I would argue will continue throughout the Cold War. And it's because of what FDR begins to do with that speech on December 8th, 1941.
Do you have a sense of how much he participated in, if not the writing of the speech, the vetting of the speech?
That is a great question. I've spent some time in the FDR archives, which are in Hyde Park, New York. And so you can look at various, scholars will call it marginalia, of the writings that FDR will make. I haven't looked at the archival documents with that particular speech. Scholars generally, you know, say that he did participate in some of the drafting of the speech. But obviously he had speechwriters that were with him. Sam Rosenman, for example, was one of his primary speechwriters who, interestingly, would go on to serve with Harry Truman. But I will say I did spend some time with the papers of Sam Rosenman looking at earlier drafts of that speech. And then FDR will give a fireside chat on December 9th, 1941. So he'll speak to the Congress. That's widely disseminated. But then he'll basically issue the same message in that fireside chat, my friend's tone. And when I was in the archives looking at those documents related to the fireside chat speech, you just see legal pads of chicken scratch and scribbling and cigarette burns and coffee rung stains. And it helps you realize, you know what, this is a moment in history in which people have no idea what is happening, no idea what to do. And being in that space and seeing those artifacts helps you remember, you know what, history is made by individual people that needed their coffee and their cigarettes as they're trying to figure out how to deal with this moment in time.
Yes, it's history in the making, but they don't know which turn
right.
it's going to take, except
right.
that they have a part in affecting it. And, of course, the vote in Congress tells
yes.
the tale there.
Mm-hmm.
Had just one dissenting vote in the whole mm-hmm. War declaration. Having raised that name, Harry Truman, let's contrast him with FDR and his rhetoric as we get solidly into the Cold War in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Alison Prash. She is the author of The World is Our Stage, The Global Rhetorical Presidency and the Cold War, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2023. Also, she's a professor of communication arts at the UW-Madison. We're talking about presidential rhetoric, and in particular the Cold War. FDR did not live to see the Cold War, having died in 1945. But it's in a way hard to imagine a greater contrast of presidential presenting than that between FDR and Harry Truman, who I think probably did not have a lot of confidence. That is, there are a lot of people did not have confidence in Truman. He was very different in appearance than FDR and very different in background. But he had to give some serious speeches.
Yes. I mean, the first thing to note is if you look at Harry Truman's diaries, he kept pretty meticulous notes as vice president, then, you know, becoming president upon FDR's death. And the day after FDR died, he writes a diary entry in which he says, oh, how I hate this. I never wanted to be president, but here I am. One cannot stress enough how much Truman did not want to be president. And yet here he was at this moment in time. And in fact, if you look at, you know, various autobiographies that are written by various Roosevelt administration officials, they all talk about how worried they are. And it's hard, again, to imagine April 1945, because so often we think about the end of World War II as this foregone conclusion. It is not. U.S., British, Russian troops are circling in on Berlin, but we don't know the end. Japan is still very much a threat in thinking about the Pacific theater of the war, and FDR dies. And so Truman is facing this moment in which not only does he have to figure out himself the business of being president, FDR was very elusive. He did not include Truman on planning. Truman didn't even know that the atomic bomb was in production when he became president.
The Russians knew, but he didn't.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So he had a lot of catching up to do, is putting it mildly. And Truman has to step into the shoes of someone who for 13 years had dominated not just U.S., but global consciousness. So we talked about how FDR is sitting in that seat in the middle of this world order that he's essentially trying to preside over and hold together. And now Truman knows nothing. And so he really is at a disadvantage. But one of the things I think that is important to remember is also in those diary entries or in letters to various family members and friends, Truman will say, but I'm president. And so I have a constitutional oath to do my best. And that's what I'm going to do. And that really is an attitude that kind of defines his presidency until, you know, 1953.
You use that date, 1947, Allison, to put a date, not a definitive date, inevitably, but a date to the Cold War. It seems that a real turning point then in heating up the Cold War, to use an oxymoron, would be 1949 when Russia gets nuclear bombs.
Yes, nuclear bombs. You also think about, you know, the what U.S. officials will describe as the fall of China or the merge to Red China, and thinking about China and you know, the People's Republic of China being formed in 1949 as well, and then in 1950, thinking about the beginning of the Korean War.
And Truman has to deal with all of that, and we now have full-fledged Cold War global situation. Truman does travel abroad. And what does he accomplish there rhetorically? And how does he do it?
Well, the first trip that that Truman takes abroad is to Potsdam. And he is going in July and August of 1945. So now we have had the fall of Berlin by this point. And really it's this third and final meeting of the big three powers. We don't know what's going to be the final one at the time, but in hindsight, we do know. And Truman goes to Potsdam to meet with Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. And, you know, a lot of historians have talked about Potsdam for what happens behind the scenes. You may have seen images of the big three and their advisors sitting around this round table. It's in this palace on the outskirts of Berlin. It's really one of the only places that they can all meet that hasn't been destroyed because of the fall of Berlin. But what I talk about in the book is that it's also really important to notice what people can see at the time of the Potsdam Conference, because as you might imagine, this is a highly guarded secret. People know that Truman is at Potsdam, but no one knows what's happening behind the scenes. And all three governments agree they won't let reporters into the compound, but they'll let photographers. And so you have these images, but you don't have any written text. And so what the public is seeing, not just the U.S. public, but more broadly a global public is seeing, is they see these images of Truman essentially stepping into FDR's shoes, both rhetorically and symbolically. So you see images of Churchill and Stalin and Truman attending dinners or sitting together. You see images that are published in Life magazine of Truman taking a driving tour of a decimated Berlin. Churchill will famously go and see Hitler's bunker where he committed suicide, and Truman refuses to do so. He thinks that's just a little bit unseemly. But through all of this, Truman will make a few public statements that get disseminated for an audience at the time. And one of them is the raising of an American flag in the U.S. sector of Berlin. So Berlin will be, you know, be divided into four sections during this visit. And Truman essentially says, you know, we're here to raise a flag of victory, not because we want to be conquerors of this space, but because we want to symbolize that the Nazi regime has been conquered. And so in his presence in Potsdam, Truman is doing two things. He's both symbolically stepping into FDR's role, but then he is also projecting to a global audience, the United States is not going anywhere. I know we lost FDR, but I am capable of taking on this mantle of leadership, and we're going to do it adhering to the principles and the vision that FDR set out.
Which he may have had to do some conferring to find out even what that was.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he, you know, to his credit, he's very explicit about what he does not know. Not externally, but if you read, you know, reports after the fact or internal archival documents that I've looked at, both from the State Department and at the Truman Library, he's very clear about what he doesn't know. And he makes sure that he talks to the people who can tell him what he needs to know. And I think that's really to his credit.
It may have cost him a re-election in 1952. And I wonder if you can tell us what he said after firing General MacArthur, which was, you know, on the face of it, a very unpopular act, given that MacArthur was a very popular man.
He was. He was. But I think, you know, what we know from Truman is that he also believed that ultimately any act that is taken on behalf of the United States should be done not for an individual, but also more broadly for the institution and upholding the institutions of the presidency, and also recognizing that you can't have a rogue actor going around, essentially, and dictating foreign policy. And so Truman, you know, he was willing to make difficult decisions even when he knew it might cost him. You can also see various decisions that he made on civil rights, for example, his willingness to desegregate the U.S. military.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. He's the first president to address the NAACP. FDR is repeatedly invited to do so, and he will not.
Eleanor, I'm sure, did.
She was very instrumental in wanting to make sure that there were, you know, overtures toward the NAACP, but FDR wouldn't do it. And so I think you see in the example of McCarthy or the example of the NAACP or the desegregation of the military, Truman was really willing to make difficult choices. And it's important to recognize those, even as we also note, right, that Harry Truman was a racist and he would say really unsavory and racist things. And so I think, you know, as we look back on history, we can both acknowledge what is true and also recognize at a moment in time the decisions that he made were also really important.
That his own personal limitations did not limit him from acting in the national interest.
Exactly. Exactly.
For one reason or another, Truman decides not to run in 1952, and we have Dwight Eisenhower, very popular, more popular than Truman at that point, I suspect. He had come through World War II, had to make the decision on D-Day, had that whole execution of that invasion on his shoulders, and showed great and consistent leadership on the world stage. But I'm trying to remember, in the Eisenhower presidency, a speech that stands out.
Well, one could argue that he gives so many that it's hard to pick a favorite. Probably, you know, we might think about, for example, the Adams for Peace speech that Eisenhower gives. But I would also argue that, you know, for a very long time, there is this belief, especially by U.S. historians, that Eisenhower wasn't that memorable. You know, maybe he did some things that were important, but there wasn't a lot that you could assign to his presidency. And then Fred Greenstein, who's a political scientist, wrote a book called The Hidden Hand Presidency. And he essentially argues that the reason that Eisenhower was such an influential and important president was because of what he did behind the scenes. That same military strategy and calculation that he developed his entire career was also what made him such an exceptional president in the 1950s. And so, and I very much agree with that assessment. And as archives have been opened, you can really make the case that although Truman was the one who picks up the mantle from FDR and is trying to make sense of how do we transition between World War II and this new Cold War and deal with China and Russia and atomic power, Eisenhower is the one who establishes clear rhetorical precedents, and specifically in elements of U.S. public diplomacy and propaganda that will shape the rest of the Cold War. The decisions that Eisenhower makes as president and the offices that he establishes now come to define how we engage in public diplomacy, even in the 21st century.
Truly.
Yes.
Well, he's operating, Eisenhower is, in a post-Stalinist Soviet Union.
Yes.
We're dealing with that, but there's still very much a divide, perhaps more than ever, between the growing military power, or let's say the regrowing military power in the Soviet Union and expansionism there, and in China also consolidating power. What kind of catchphrases, if you will, would Eisenhower use to summarize the difference between them and us?
Well, Eisenhower loved good descriptors, and he also loved really clear demarcations between what we might think of kind of these defining terms of the Cold War, whether it's us and them, whether it's good versus evil, godless communism versus God-fearing Americans, for example. Those dichotomies really do characterize what Eisenhower would develop through his rhetoric. But I think the one that sticks out more than any other one is he would often use the word or the phrase our way of life in contrast to another. And that way of life descriptor is not Eisenhower's. It comes with Wilson. And he talks about why should we make the world safe for democracy? It's the difference between one way of life versus another. Truman will pick it up when he returns from Potsdam. He will talk about our way of life versus another. Eisenhower will continue this theme, and you see it throughout the Cold War, and it's this reassertion over and over again that there are two fundamental ways of life that are at odds with one another. And so if you have an enemy, what do? You fight it with every weapon in your arsenal. And in the case of the Cold War, yes, there are military skirmishes, but for Eisenhower, he sees this as a fundamentally a global battle of public opinion of which way of life will the international public choose.
And J.F. Kennedy, when he's elected in 1960, is very much operating under that us versus them concept.
Yes, yes, he is. And he will pick up that phrase again, our way of life versus another. And really that transition from Eisenhower to Kennedy, it's interesting because it's, you know, as we famously know, JFK will say it's, you know, a new generation of Americans. And it really is this generational shift between Eisenhower, who's this, you know, decorated general of World War II, responsible for D-Day, presides over the 1950s. And Kennedy is this youthful senator from Massachusetts. But he has the same view of the world and this polarized vision of the Soviet Union versus the United States, and seeing America's role in the world is really being important and significant for the future.
And it's most conspicuous, isn't it, in Europe? And again, that gets us right back to Berlin, which is the pressure point of the whole thing.
And Berlin, you know, really is this centerpiece, we could say, of thinking about how and why presidents choose to travel and where they choose to go. Because if you think about the story of Berlin, we started by talking about Potsdam. It's just outside of Berlin. After Truman's in Potsdam and in 1948, we have the Berlin airlift. The Soviets are cutting off supplies into various sectors of the city. And at that moment, it's remarkable how Berlin, that was once the capital of Nazi Germany, becomes really the symbol of Western resolve that, no, the United States and Great Britain, we will fly planes every hour and drop supplies to make sure that this symbol survives.
And the Soviets blinked, didn't they?
Absolutely. 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 So by the time, you know, Kennedy is coming into office, he delivers this campaign speech in which he says, you know, Berlin is this testing point of American resolve in the Cold War. And to be clear, Berlin itself as a city in the Cold War is not necessarily a strategic point. It's in the middle of Soviet-controlled territory. It's not as if it's this really key military outpost. It really doesn't matter from a military perspective. What matters is the symbolism and what Berlin has come to represent.
What was the upshot then of that speech, Ich bin ein Berliner?
Well, Kennedy doesn't know if he wants to go to Berlin, actually. So Kennedy comes into office. Berlin is, you know, a concern, but it's during Kennedy's administration when the Berlin Wall will go up. And after the Berlin Wall goes up, Kennedy's been really open about the fact that he believes the symbolism of Berlin is central. And then for days, he says nothing. And there are protests in West Berlin now at this point saying, you know, why is Kennedy silent? And Kennedy dispatches both Lyndon Johnson and his brother, Robert Kennedy, to deliver speeches in West Berlin to articulate U.S. commitment. But it's finally when Kennedy decides to make a trip to Europe. So he meets with the Pope. He also goes.
Which is an interesting move because being the first Catholic president and the previous effort way back, mm-hmm. as it was at L. Smith, did not get too far in his campaign in 1920, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. But JFK, kind of controversial, first Catholic president. Will he bow to the Pope or to American policy? Mm-hmm. But he goes to see the Pope.
He goes to see the Pope. It's part of the visit. And in the planning documents in the JFK archives in Boston, there are these exchanges between Kennedy and various officials and records of meeting minutes. And essentially, the debate is, will Kennedy go to Berlin? And essentially, advisors agree, you can't go to Europe and not go to Berlin. And especially, and he was planning also to visit other cities in West Germany. And so really, it was viewed as snubbing West Germany and West Berliners if he didn't go. And so there are these back and forth moves and debates. And finally, Kennedy decides to go. And then if you look at the advance records, there are all of these debates about where he'll go in West Berlin. Will he go to look at the wall? Will he go to see the Brandenburg Gate, which at that time, you know, has really become this symbol between East and West? And the Kennedy administration leans into it and they say, no, he's going to go. We're going to have pictures of him at all of these places. We're going to make sure we have newspaper reporters and newsreel footage taken, and we'll make sure to fly this footage overnight back to various places where it can be disseminated across the Western world, because it's so important that the U.S. public and a global audience sees Kennedy in West Berlin.
Well, we know the sad story of the end of the Kennedy administration later in that year of 1963, and Lyndon Johnson, his vice president, mm-hmm. becomes president. And I wonder if we could shift, we're still in the Cold War, but shift our globe around a little bit mm-hmm. and look at Asia mm-hmm. and JFK mm-hmm. and then his successor, Johnson, mm-hmm. in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Would you call that still a kind of a Cold War proxy, hot war, the whole Vietnam War?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, what's interesting as we tell these stories of the Cold War is for a very long time within histories of the Cold War, there is this tendency to focus on Europe and to not be really explicit about what's happening in Asia. But in fact, there's a really important argument to be made that some of the most harmful and dangerous things that happen in terms of the projection of U.S. power and influence happen in Asia, either by omission or commission. Right. And so it's significant, for example, going back to Eisenhower for just a moment, the Bandung Conference happens in 1955. And it's this moment in which they call themselves non-aligned nations, say, you know, we shouldn't have to choose between these two ways of life that are being presented to us. And in fact, doing so means that we are essentially giving in to this descriptor of the world. But by the time you get to Kennedy and then Johnson and thinking about Vietnam, it becomes much less clear what U.S. military presence overseas means when, as we now know in hindsight, for really destructive ends, and the motivation behind the Vietnam War is this idea of preserving this American prestige and way of life. And, you know, the history of the Vietnam War is long and complex and is very, very complicated. But every decision that is made that further engulfs the United States into Vietnam really does revolve around what U.S. commitment looks like to, quote unquote, protecting and defending democracy. That's the same argument that's made about Berlin. It's the same argument that Wilson tries to make. And so it's how you can see and chart how these various moments or decisions contribute to this vision of what American influence abroad should look like. And then what do you do when you realize that maybe it's not as rosy and robust as you've been told it is?
Is LBJ the first U.S. president who actually in office goes to a war zone by going to Vietnam?
Yes, he is. Although, I mean, you could say that Truman and going to Potsdam, you know, several weeks later. But yes, LBJ is the first one to travel to a war zone.
The war is still very much going on.
Yeah, it's very much
going on. LBJ goes there.
Yes.
What kind of pronouncement does he make?
LBJ is, I would argue, he's going there both to see and to be seen. He is going there to assess the situation, but also to subtly communicate to a broader audience that I am here and I have this under control at a moment when it really matters that he projects that image to his audience.
And again, very easy now to get footage.
Yes.
And send it.
Yep.
Almost instantly.
Yep.
We're going to look further at presidential rhetoric during the Cold War when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Allison Prash, professor of communication arts at the UW-Madison and author of The World Is Our Stage, The Global Rhetorical Presidency in the Cold War, published in 2023 by the University of Chicago Press. It's a phrase. It's also the name of an opera, Nixon in China.
Yes.
And that was a very well-publicized set of moves. What does Nixon say? Not maybe the world's greatest speaker, but what does he say from China?
Well, when Nixon goes to China, we have to remember, first of all, how and why Nixon sees this as such an important diplomatic and rhetorical move. The United States has not had diplomatic relations with China for almost 30 years. No contact. And Nixon decides very early on in his administration that he wants to try to begin contact. And so Henry Kissinger, his Secretary of State, begins, you know, top secret negotiations through intermediaries. So by the time that Nixon announces to the world on July 15th, 1971, that he is going to make a visit to China, it sends diplomatic shockwaves around the nation and around the world. Also because we have to remember, Nixon is Eisenhower's vice president. And one scholar has referred to Nixon as, quote, the Republican hatchet man on China, unquote. So he is known to be this staunch anti-communist and would frequently refer to the horrors or the evils of Red China. So the fact that, you know, there's this also this saying only Nixon can go to China, that's one of the reasons. But Nixon shifts his rhetoric as he begins to prepare for this trip and when he is in China. And it's a set. It's a week-long trip. It's highly choreographed and orchestrated. The White House Communications Office spends enormous time making sure that every move, every dinner, every opera performance, every public-facing event will be seen by audiences around the world. But it will also be broadcast live in the United States. This is the early days of broadcast news, right? And so there are memos in the archive talking about, we want people to come home from dinner and all gather around their televisions or come home for dinner, gather around their televisions and watch Nixon in China. So Nixon's, you know, actual words that he says in China are pretty scripted. You know, they're prepared to be delivered often alongside Chou Enlai, for example, or other Chinese officials. And they're pretty tame. And I would argue, actually, the thing that's most important that Nixon does from China is not necessarily what he says, but the visual images that this creates and circulates to a U.S. public.
Shaking
that really,
hands with Chairman Mao.
Absolutely. Right. That is a remarkable moment, really, just that this, we talked about dichotomies, right, that Nixon can be saying the evils of Red China, and now he's there in the flesh. That's what's most significant about this trip, and really, you know, contributes to this vision of Nixon and pursuing detente or accommodation with Chinese officials. And we know that it's a way to kind of also project U.S. Opposition to the Soviet Union. And so Nixon basically decides, okay, well, if I can have a relationship with the Chinese, that's going to help me against the Russians. And so that's the choice that he makes.
The famous China card.
Yes.
I don't remember Jimmy Carter having that kind of splash in the Cold War in terms of his presentations.
You know, there's a lot. I would argue that Carter is a really underappreciated U.S. president. And what's interesting, thinking about Nixon and then thinking about Reagan, is that both men were so determined to portray a very particular image of themselves, and they made choices about where they would go to contribute to that image. Carter travels abroad. he's involved in international affairs, but we also know him probably most famously for Iran-Contra, right?
Yes,
the places where things go wrong.
Which didn't work out so
right?
well, yeah.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, to be successful in these diplomatic tours, you have to really care about making yourself look good. And you have to be egocentric. And that, I mean, absolutely, Carter had an ego, but that was not what drove him in every possible way.
Well, on the other hand, we did have this president who had plenty of experience presenting himself because he was a well-known actor.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that part down.
Yep.
And he was probably a master of the soundbite.
Mm-hmm.
And Ronald Reagan, did he end the Cold War?
Ah, that is the question that many people believe he did. I would say, from my perspective and research that I've done, he contributes to it. He's not solely responsible for ending the Cold War.
I mean, he did just outspend the Russians.
Yes,
that was part
absolutely.
Of it.
Absolutely, he did. And he also, I think, you know, for a U.S. public who is concerned about U.S. influence abroad, Vietnam rattles the nation in very particular ways. Reagan uses his rhetoric to communicate a vision of the nation to the U.S. public that really points them back to where we started, World War II, and what is, you know, the job of the United States on the global stage. How can you believe in that? I mean, let's remember, Reagan is the first one to use the phrase, make America great again. He is able to communicate and articulate a very particular vision of the world and the United States' place in that world that is palatable and attractive to many Americans.
Kind of a retro image, though.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he reappropriates it for people living in the 1980s. And a lot of that has to do with, yes, he was skilled as an actor, understood sound bites. He also had very smart communication.
And charisma.
Yeah, and charisma and the ability to make complex policy proposals often come to life through his rhetoric.
Well, he was famous for, at least behind the scenes, simplifying them down to one page, whatever it might be. And that gets you the sound bite and that gets you the crowd a lot of times. Seems to me he had another advantage, though, in the Cold War, and that was he was working with Gorbachev, who was the most, let's say, globally minded, I think, Soviet leader of all, by far. Reagan famously goes to, I think he went to the wall itself, but said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Mm-hmm. Yep, he delivers that speech with the wall as the backdrop. And you know, the interesting thing about that speech is that many of Reagan's staff members, people from the State Department, cross that line out again and again and again. And he refuses to not to let it be taken out. And he just adds it in again and again. And now that's one of the most famous lines that we know from that particular speech.
Let's see. So that was what year?
That's 87.
87. The wall comes down. 91.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So probably just as well that he did put that line back in.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the appeals that Reagan offers rhetorically, right, is people would say, well, he just says what we want to be said and what we want to be argued and is willing to call Gorbachev out on what he thinks should be done. And for some Republicans, it is seen really in opposition to Nixon, who they would say was accommodating China through this policy of detente.
An opinion question to wrap things up here, having touched on Ronald Reagan, who was sometimes called the great communicator. Any president since then, do you think, has reached that level of being able to communicate so effectively with the American public? And I guess the second part would be, is it a fair question?
Well, to your second question, is it a fair question? You know, as someone who studies presidential rhetoric for my job, I think it is a fair question because, we utilize our scholarly training and our study of history to make assessments. Now, one can disagree with those assessments, so it's a fair question. You know, one of the things that I think we have to consider when we ask whether presidents are effective communicators, yes, there needs to be something to how they communicate with us, how they sound, what types of appeals they offer. But we also have to ask, what vision of the nation are they communicating? And can we see ourselves as a part of that? So I would say, you know, Reagan does offer a vision of the nation that is inclusive for some, but not all. And it is a very white vision. And it's a very, you know, middle to upper class vision. I would say that Obama, probably more than any other president after Reagan, is able to offer an inclusive vision of the nation that deliberately disrupts a white-centric narrative.
Well, he became Obama famous through a speech before he was even president.
Absolutely.
That's kind of led very quickly, didn't it, to his nomination and election?
Absolutely. And he's making the argument of saying, you know, I am the embodiment of the American dream, right? The son of a Black man and a white woman from Kansas, right? And so obviously he is the nation's first Black president. But he is also able to articulate parts of this national narrative or story that have excluded some individuals and bring those individuals back in as part of the narrative. He does this famously in his speech at Selma, marking the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, in which he essentially re-narrates the story of the nation and says it doesn't just include Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln. It also includes all of these individuals who perhaps haven't been seen to be named, but they deserve a place in the story, where the immigrants and the farmers and the hucksters, right? And so I think we shouldn't just ask how presidents sound, but what's the image or the vision of the nation that they're trying to communicate to us? And is that the vision of the country that we want?
Do you think it has become so diffuse now in terms of all the communication media that it would be hard to have a speech that would resonate like that?
It's become much more complicated and difficult. I think you see, for example, right now the Biden White House and campaign attempting to package various bits of the president's speeches, whether that's on TikTok or that's
not TikTok, I hope, anymore.
Yeah, well, yes, I'm referring to, you know, various decisions, but also thinking about, you know, how you put it on various social media channels. But this idea, right, going back to FDR and December 8th, 1941, the fact that every household essentially in the United States is tuned into listening to him, no, that does not happen anymore. And so I think, though, you know, with changes in media technology also come changes in presidential speech. And I think it's worth trying to shift with those dynamics, because I do believe that it is to our benefit to have an individual who can speak to us and about us and for us in a way that would attempt to unify the nation.
And it would help to have that person have a dynamic quality to give the speech in the first place, whatever the media might be for disseminating it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Alison Prash, it has been a pleasure. There's much more that you could tell us, I'm sure, about the art and the effect of presidential rhetoric. And maybe we'll take another angle on it next time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Tom Blaine. And I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air. Thank you.